Okay, good afternoon. Everybody can continue eating. That is fine. It's all right. We're in a public space. There's a base medrash here. Everybody going back and forth. Okay, so the topic we discussed, what Todd put out, is Yerushalayim in the Megillah. So right away, Alan A. said, hey, is it in the Megillah? So yeah, it is one spot. It's not actually, I didn't really even think about that. It is talked about in the second chapter where we are introduced to Mordechai as the person who was exiled from Yerushalayim with the exile that took place earlier. The truth is, as we'll see, Mordechai actually was exiled from Yerushalayim three times. Right. Well, his family was exiled. His family is exiled actually twice in that verse. His reference is being exiled twice because, as we'll see, there's various levels of the exile. That was part of the confusion that formed the beginning of the Book of Esther. And then Mordechai himself had been to Yerushalayim because we normally think about the story of Purim taking place between Beis Hamikdash 1 and Beis Hamikdash 2. The Beis Hamikdash 1 is destroyed and they go to Babel. All sorts of things happen over there in Babylon. Somehow there's a switch from Babylonians to Persians. That happens at some point. I'm not exactly sure like where that happens. But and then the Purim story happens, and then a little bit after that, Bnei Yisrael gets to go, the Jews get to go back to Eretz Yisrael, and they get to rebuild the Beis Hamikdash, the second Beis Hamikdash. Now, the problem is that historically that's not exactly how it went. What is in Yerushalayim at the point during the time of the Purim story? What is happening there? Are there any Jews in Yerushalayim during the time of the Purim story? Yes. Who would be in Yerushalayim during the time of the Purim story? So the Ezra people, right? The first group of the King Cyrus, right? Cyrus is the one credited with giving the Jews permission to go ahead and build the second Beis Hamikdash. So that happened already. So there was already some part. They had already started construction on the Beis Hamikdash. In fact, so therefore, in order to really understand the context of the story of Purim, you actually have to go back to the Book of Ezra. Now, the Book of Ezra and the Book of Nehemiah is not just before the Purim story. It's actually before and after, with the Purim story not really being mentioned very much at all in the Book of Ezra. Now, there is an allusion, though, a couple of allusions, and that is that we have a couple of lists in the Book of Ezra, right? The Book of Ezra opens up with Ezra requesting from Koresh coming to the recognition that maybe it would be a good idea to allow the Jewish people to go back to Yerushalayim. He sends them back, led by Ezra. That group that goes back to Yerushalayim gets there. They get to work, and their progress is halted. Why? Because the natives are not so thrilled. Or I shouldn't say natives, that's not necessarily the best term. But those that had been living there over the last couple of decades are not so thrilled with these Jews showing up and all of a sudden building a lot there, especially when they have a lot of money coming from a foreign power. Right? Does that sound familiar, perhaps? Right? So they go back, and that group starts to undermine the efforts to rebuild the Beis Hamikdash, and in fact sends a letter back to Koresh saying, you know, this isn't working out. These Jews have come and they're raising a ruckus and, you know, it's all sort of mischief and things aren't peaceful here anymore. At which point Koresh says, you're right, maybe we should stop the rebuilding of the Beis Hamikdash. And that's where things are. That's where things are. Now, in the second chapter of Ezra, we get a list of all the people that are going there. And these are the people that left the captivity of the Galus, the captivity of the exile that Nebuchadnezzar had started, and returned to Yerushalayim. Asher bo im Zerubbabel, Yeshu, Nehemiah, Sariah, Reilaya, and Mordechai, Bilshan. As well as Mordechai. Now, it could be, some say, okay, Mordechai was a very common name back there, kind of like Alan in our shul, right? There are a lot of Mordechais. However, many do point to that being Mordechai. Now, if that is Mordechai how does Mordechai end up back at the Shar HaMelech? How does he end up back at the gate of the king? Because, again, this took place about, I think I don't know my chronology, that was in my notes, but whatever, say 10, 15 years before the story of Esther takes place.
That's not so much of a difference.
Yeah, it's not so far. Mordechai is actually appointed with the mission of, can we go back and talk to Koresh and get this thing started again? So therefore, Mordechai, being a pretty impressive person, I mean, this is an entire chapter of names, and Mordechai's in the first verse. So he was clearly a guy that had some importance. He goes back to Bavel in order to get things started. He can't quite get it. You know, the kingdom has changed. It's now moved on from Koresh to Achashverosh, and he can't seem to get an audience. But he has worked himself into the group that is surrounding the king, hoping to, at some point, finally be able to restart and jumpstart the rebuilding of the second Beis HaMikdash. So that is apparent. That is the first obvious connection with regards to Yerushalayim and this story. Beyond that, when we think about the Purim story, so what is it a story of? So generally, we assume it is a story of this dude named Haman. Haman had come along and said, you know, I'm really tired of these Jews over here. We're going to take them all out. We're going to have the final solution, right, and just kill all the Jewish people, and the world will be rid of Jews, and Esther and Mordechai were then able to overcome that, and that's what we celebrate on Purim, right? So that is certainly one front of the war. The other front of the war, the other front of the story is this background of the Beis HaMikdash being built. In fact, the Medrash tells us, this I dug up at some today actually, the Medrash, there is a Medrash in the Yalkut Shimoni on Esther, where it says that who was the main instigator in Yerushalayim in attempting to undermine the building of the Beis HaMikdash and actually sent the letters back and was in charge of that? None other than Haman. That Haman actually was in Yerushalayim, so Haman and Mordechai go back. Now the Gemara itself alludes to them having a backstory together. One was a barber. There's a whole story in there. But even besides that, the Medrash already alludes to Haman. In fact, the Medrash continues on and says that Haman very much that because Haman was in charge of halting the building of the Beis HaMikdash, he already was deserving of the death penalty. That already was enough that he would have been in a lot of trouble and Hashem was going to punish him. But we wanted to see to it that what was the big issue for the building of the second Beis HaMikdash? They needed money. So how are they going to get some money? So Haman actually had a lot of money. So perhaps he'd be able to be shaken down at some point and be able to get his money, which is ultimately what happened. So already that Medrash is weaving the story of Haman, of Mordechai and Haman. It's not just about these two people that are meeting for the first time, but rather that is there is a larger struggle about the rebuilding of the second Beis HaMikdash that is clearly being that is being worked out between the two of them. Beyond that, another connection is just the attitude. This the Sfas Emes writes about, the Ger Rebbe writes about, that the difference between the first and second Beis HaMikdash was about the clarity of the divine presence being there, right? Was the fires that go straight up, the Lechem HaPanim that stayed fresh, the Aron itself that was present, all of those miracles, which the Gemara says existed in the first Beis HaMikdash and did not exist in the second Beis HaMikdash. So what is the story of Purim? Purim is sort of the first major story that happened to the Jewish people where we assume that there is much divine intervention without it being obvious divine intervention, where it is considered a nes nistari, hidden miracle, rather than a nes nigla, rather than an open miracle. And that perhaps was the transition necessary to get the Jewish people ready for the second base of Migdash. The first base of Migdash was one of Nigla, was one of open miracles. The second base of Migdash was going to be one of Nistar, was going to be one of hidden miracles. And that transition takes place over the second base of Migdash. It's developed even further, the difference between the Torah Shebichsav and the Torah Shebaal Peh. Right? Esther is the, not the last, but getting towards the end of the Torah Shebichsav. Right, the written Torah was given to us at Har Sinai. Was given to us by Nevuah. Was written by Nevi'im, and then but Esther is now sort of taking the turn on that into the realm of oral tradition, which is the responsibility is not on sort of Hashem, rather the responsibility is on us in order to make sure that the tradition is maintained. Okay, so we have, let's see, we have placed Esther historically in between Ezra's beginning of the building of the second base of Mikdash and the continuation later on of when it's going to be completed. We have taken Haman and taken him not just as a person who's attempting to destroy the Jewish people, but also perhaps was triggered by the building of the Beis HaMikdash itself. That was his first battle, was to make sure that the Beis HaMikdash is stopped to be built, and then he gets brought back. We have the transition necessary for the second Beis HaMikdash, that it's going to be required more hidden miracles rather than the clarity that comes with open miracles. And then we'll probably toss in two more ideas. So one more idea then is, now it takes us to the aftermath of the Purim story. Because what happens to Esther at the end of the Purim story? Where is she? What happens to her?
She's still queen.
She's still the queen, right? We don't see anywhere in the Purim story that Esther is no longer the queen. She stays with Achashverosh. And her being the queen of Achashverosh, right? So presumably they may have had children. So did they have children together?
Darius, maybe?
Ah, so very good. So the next king after Achashverosh is this person named Daryavish. Now Daryavish, or Darius as he's known, does appear in the... what is his major claim to fame, at least as far as the Jews are concerned? And that is, he was the one who permitted the continuation of the building of the second base of Mikdash. So that Achashverosh, at no point does he say, go ahead and build it. In fact, right, we talk about in the middle where Achashverosh says, Achatzi ha-malchus v'teyas, that I will give you up to half the kingdom could be yours. That's what he says to Esther. Right? Achatzi ha-malchus, right? You can have up to half the kingdom. And immediately Rashi says, what is the half he's not giving her? The rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. So Achashverosh is not willing to grant her the building of the Beis HaMikdash. So often, you learn that the first time, it's like, what does that have to do with anything? Why would that be the connection? So you say, no, Achatzi ha-malchus, I'll give you half of the thing, but don't get me started on this Jerusalem thing. That's not going to happen under my reign. And that's what happens. It does not happen under his reign. Rather, it happens under his son's reign, under Daryavish's reign. And they do continue to build it. And there is the book of Nehemiah opens up with Nehemiah coming back. This is, 20 years after Ezra, right? It's all one book. But coming back and realizing that they need help. They need help, to rebuild. They need money. They need support. They need protection. They need a whole bunch of things. And Nehemiah is the one that appears in front of Daryavish. And the pasuk here, in the very beginning of Nehemiah, right, so the king says, yeah, so the pasuk says, Vayomer li hamelech, almaze atam avakesh, what are you requesting? Vespalel el Hashem ha-shamayim. So what do you request? He says, and then, this is Nehemiah talking, so then I dive into Hashem. Vayomer el hamelech, and I said to the king, Imal hamelech tov, imitiv avdecha lefanecha, right? Imal hamelech tov, that's also a phrase that maybe is familiar to us from Megillas Esther, right? If it's good with the king, and if he's okay, asher tshalchenu el Yehuda el ir kvaros avos ha-bevnena, right? May you be... let me go to the city of my ancestors' graves, meaning Yerushalayim, so that I will rebuild it. So Nehemiah is asking for a release to be able to go back to Yerushalayim.
So he started out in Yerushalayim.
I think so. I think he was sent. I think he.
He wasn't in the English line and said, okay, well, you know, I better go talk to this other guy.
One second.
Some information.
Yeah, Nehemiah was left in Persia. He was left in Persia. So he was the one who was tasked with this.
Right, okay.
So, and he wants to leave. And he wants to go. So Vayomer li hamelech v'hashegel yoshev etzlo. So there's this pasuk here. As he's about to give his answer, he says, the king says to me, with this shegel sitting next to him, we'll get to that in a second. Ad masi ye mahalcho masai tashu v'yiti lufnei hamelech v'yishalcheni v'etna luzman. He says, how long are you going to go? When are you going to come back? And the king was okay with it, and he let me go. So the Malbim says, who is this Shegel? What is a Shegel? So it's unclear, but he translated as queen. Now,
so who is this queen?
So the Malbim suggests that it was none other than Esther. And not necessarily being the queen, the Shegel is usually a reference to like the old queen. So Daryavish Esther wasn't Daryavish's queen, Esther was Daryavish's mother, right? That's the way the theory goes. And so therefore the Shegel, being the old queen, was next to him, like the old wise woman was there, sort of prodding him, saying, come on, Daryavish, let him have it, let him go. Right? And therefore the suggestion is that Esther was behind the permission for Nehemiah to go back and finally to rebuild the second base of Mikdash.
Is Mordecai gone?
Mordechai is not in the story. I don't know. I'm not sure what the Mordechai story is. Now, remember, Mordechai at the end of Esther was not so well liked at that point, right? He was not everybody was so thrilled with him. He had a political position, which maybe disqualified him from this at that point. Meaning, maybe that's why he wouldn't be accessible, because he had other considerations. Maybe.
Yeah, I did remember tomorrow, McGill, there's some pushback.
Yeah. Actually, at a previous year, we spoke about that pasuk, and I actually got in trouble. It was one of my rebbeim from high school called me and said, I listened to your shir, and I disagree. It wasn't about politics, it was about Torah, and the whole thing. So I want to be careful, because he might be listening to this year's also. But anyways,
So that is
a suggestion that maybe that was Esther. Now, to add in just a little bit more intrigue, if Esther was Daryavish's mother, and Esther was Jewish, what does that make Daryavish?
Well, the timing is.
No, what does that make him in terms of his religion?
No.
Right, so that makes him Jewish as well. Now you're right. The story, right? The timing, why? How young he was? It also makes him pretty young. Right, that is true. So that's maybe why he needed the wise Esther giving him instructions as to what to do. Because, you know, you're a young man. Let me make sure that I'm there being able to help you out. So that is also invoked, by the way, even nowadays, that people say, how could it be that there's any importance to the government in Israel? Well, they're all not religious, even though it's not so true anymore, but they're all not religious, etc. So some point out, well, Daryavish was Jewish, and he wasn't religious. He for sure wasn't religious, and yet he's given credit with the building of the second Beis HaMikdash. And that finally is what enables us. This is the last point. That is what enables us to be able to celebrate the holiday of Purim. Meaning, there is traditions throughout our history of Jews that were under attack and were able to withstand attacks. In fact, very often those days are known as Purims. Different cities had their Purim. And I think the most famous one is, I think, Purim Frankfurt, which there was an attempt to destroy the Jewish people of Frankfurt. They were able to overcome it. And they celebrated that day continually. I think even until today. I think in the Breuer's community, I think they acknowledge the Purim of Frankfurt even until today, because they were saved in that way. But Purim is beyond that. Purim is celebrated throughout the world, right? All the Jewish people celebrate them, not just those who were locally saved. So one could say, well, because the whole Jewish people are under attack. Right? Okay, maybe. But the other suggestion that Sir Schechter develops is that no, that wouldn't have given the ability to create mitzvos. The ability to create mitzvos is only if you're able to associate it with the building of the Beis HaMikdash, with being part of something towards the construction of the Beis HaMikdash, just like Hanukkah is part of the, it has to be Beis HaMikdash related. So we get to the end of this Purim story, and you're like, okay, well, where is the connection to the Beis HaMikdash? So with this background, you're then able to say, oh, well, this obviously played a very key role in the building of the Beis HaMikdash, and therefore enables us to be able to celebrate it throughout the world. In fact,
but there must have been a period of a few decades in which they were celebrating Purim, but the second Beis HaMikdash had
right, but at that point it was the people were, that might have been because we were simply saved right away. I mean, there is an allowance to be saved if you personally were saved, or you can relate, but if it's But for it to be something that we don't really relate to the Jews of Persia. I mean, are we descendants of them? Maybe yes, maybe no. We're not sure.
Virtually all the Jews must have been in Persia.
So yeah. Now as we're discussing this,
except for the ones in Jerusalem.
Jerusalem was included as part of the Persian Empire. Okay, that's why he was given permission. They might have been in Europe. There were definitely Jews that went to Europe. In fact, there is a famous part of the kinos that we say on Tisha B'Av, right, is about the Crusades, right? So there they discuss the downfall of the German, that the Germans specifically suffered, because there is a story that they sent a letter to the German Jews in this time, during the time of the rebuilding of the second Beis HaMikdash. Okay, rebuilding, why don't you come back? And they were like, you know what, we're good. We're good up here in Germany. We're very comfortable. Things are okay. Yeah. So how historical that is unclear, but the fact that Jews would have gone north and part of their exile, I think that does make sense. And that does play a role also in sort of the Ashkenazi, Sephardi, Bavli, Yerushalmi, how this all sort of plays itself out. But there is, if Schechter in his article points out, he's not the first one to point out, but when they are establishing the holiday of Purim, they gathered in the 14th and 15th, and they said the 14th, etc. Right, Yom Arba Salochan Shdar Simcha Umishteh V'Yom Tov. So originally they wrote it as the 14th day will be a day of simcha and mishnah, happiness and rejoicing, or celebrate, you know, food celebrations. The yom tov, umishloach manos ish l'reihu. The second time around, it's changed. So yimei mishteh v'simcha, umishloach manos ish l'reihu, umatanos le'avyonim. What, so one word is added, that's clear, that is matanos le'avyonim, the mitzvah matanos le'avyonim. What is removed? The removed from that is Yom Tov, that originally it's wanted to establish it as a Yom Tov, as a day of an Isser Melacha, that it would be like a full-fledged Yom Tov, and that was removed, because the people were like, you know, that's too much, we can't take the extra day off from work, we're already taking 2 days off all the time, etc. So they didn't accept it as a Yom Tov. But what would be the impetus for it to actually be a Yom Tov? So there also, only if it was going to be a harbinger of the building of the Beis HaMikdash, and it could be that's what Jewish people there saw. Yeah, it doesn't take a big imagination to say, oh, now Mordechai is holding the ring of the king, right? This should get us places. This should get us to the building of the second Beis HaMikdash, right? That wasn't a crazy thing, and that's maybe what they saw originally. That, oh, we're going to use this as a jumping off point in order to go ahead and build the second Beis HaMikdash, which ultimately it did, which ultimately they were able to do. Okay, so there's a couple of things, hopefully putting Megillah in a greater context, and just as then the Pali of Purim was a jumping off point towards the building of the Beis HaMikdash, so to hear this here under difficult circumstances, we should continue to see Purim as a jumping off point for the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Okay, Yashar Koach, thank you everybody for coming. Everybody can thank Gladys.